In 1874, Lewis Miller and John Vincent opened a summer retreat for Sunday school teachers on the shore of Lake Chautauqua in western New York State. Today, the Chautauqua Institution is known around the world as a bastion of faith, art, learning, and fellowship. One of the highlights of the 9-week summer season at the Chautauqua Institution is the morning lecture series, where the best minds of our day explore the issues facing mankind. The speaker today is Taylor Branch. Taylor Branch is an author and historian, best known for his award-winning trilogy of books chronicling the life of Martin Luther King Jr. and the history of the American Civil Rights Movement. The third and final volume of the 2,912-page trilogy, collectively called America and the King Years, was released in January 2006. The trilogy has been described as a three-volume history that will endure as a masterpiece of storytelling on American race, violence, and democracy. Branch graduated from the Westminster School in Atlanta in 1964. From there, he went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill on a prestigious Morehouse Scholarship. He graduated in 1968 and went on to earn an MPA from the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton in 1970. Branch served as the assistant editor of the Washington Monthly from 70 to 73. He was Washington editor of Harper's from 73 to 76, and he was Washington columnist for Esquire magazine from 76 to 77. He's also written for a wide variety of other publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Sport, The New Republic, and Texas Monthly. Although Mr. Branch was raised in the segregated South, he never gave much thought to race relations until he saw pictures of police in riot gear using dogs and fire hoses to break up peaceful freedom rallies in Selma, Alabama. Here is Taylor Branch in a lecture entitled Miracles and Myths from the King Era, recorded Wednesday, August 23, 2006.
The original Black Panthers were not gun-toting rebels from Oakland, but sharecropper women in Lowndes County, Alabama, who voted for the first time in 1966. They had never voted in the entire 20th century, not a single black person in Lowndes County. They were organized by Stokely Carmichael, who got these sharecroppers to register and vote for the first time, and they decided that as long as they were going to do all that and risk their lives, they might as well run for office. So they had workshops on county coroner and sheriff and the tax commissioner and the board of education. And these people decided that they were going to run and risk their lives. They had to have a ballot symbol. By Alabama law in that day and age, you had to have a ballot symbol because there were a lot of less than literate voters. The official symbol for the Alabama Democratic Party was a rooster with a banner over it that said white supremacy for the right. In their debates, they decided if we're going to vote for the first time in our lives, we don't want to vote for the white rooster and white supremacy. So they had a lot of discussions. They were farm people, and they said, what scares roosters? So they decided that cats chase chickens and that they would try to have a ballot symbol somewhat derived from a cat. And with no more instruction than that, Stokely Carmichael sent some volunteers back to Atlanta to find an image of a cat that they could put on the ballot. They went over to Atlanta University, the consorted predominantly African-American colleges there, and found out that the football mascot for the Clark College Panthers was a panther. They traced the panther, brought it back to Alabama, voted in a meeting. The ladies voted to become the Lowndes County Freedom Organization with this image from the college as their symbol. Now, this effort, the FBI was saying, if you vote, they will shoot you. So they were trying to get them not to vote for the first time in May of 1966. So they decided to vote outdoors, so that if they were going to be shot, they would be shot in the wide open spaces. They voted anyway. They almost won, but the county coroner, they didn't quite win. This entire effort was denounced by the New York Times as sabotage in Alabama because they weren't voting in the Democratic primary. They felt that it was a waste of the right to vote, which was a sad, in my view, tragic misunderstanding of efforts not seen since Valley Forge, ordinary citizens sacrificing for the cause of democracy. Stokely finally, Carmichael finally said he had had enough, denounced it, denounced nonviolence, the vote, and democracy itself in speeches in California, told the story of Lowndes County, and a gentleman named Huey Newton asked if he could borrow the idea of the Black Panthers from Alabama. The sad part of all of this story is that every one of you, I'm sure, has heard many stories and seen images of the Black Panthers from Oakland, California. But the Black Panthers from Lowndes County, Alabama, are lost in history. That's one reason I'm here, to try to rescue lessons from this period and to try to reconcile today with that history, because I think that we are out of phase with it. Now, this is not a natural, by way of a personal introduction, this is not a natural story for me. I do not come from a political family, a historian's family. I was born in Atlanta, where Martin Luther King was born. I lived there, I grew up there, but I never even saw him in the flesh. I wasn't particularly interested in it. My father had a dry cleaning plant. His motto for the family was that anyone interested in politics can't find honest work. He was from the greatest generation, the World War II Depression generation, who thought that work was the answer to every problem, and that political agitation was not. He had me working in the cleaners from the time I was about 5 years old. My first job was putting the trouser guards, the paper trouser guards, on coat hangers by the boxes of 500. I wasn't very good at it, and his employees shifted me around to other jobs. Virtually all the employees were black. I still remember them all. They treated me as a very troublesome person who was nevertheless the boss's son. So had a tendentious relationship with them all. My favorite one was Peter Mitchell. He was the cleaner, the one who had the nastiest job in the dry cleaning plant. He puts all the clothes in the wheel and gets them out full of the fumes from a dry cleaning fluid. They're unmistakable if you've ever smelled them. Peter would arrive every morning at 6:30 in the morning, dressed like he was going to meet the Queen of England, in a three-piece suit and what he called his $100 shoes. Years later, my dad told me that Peter told him that that was what the only way he thought it was safe for a black man to get across the streets of Atlanta early in the morning, was to dress like he was a person of substance, which he did, and he changed clothes as soon as he got there into the rattiest outfit you ever saw to work with these clothes. And by the time he had changed clothes, almost every day he and my father would have played three or four practical jokes on one another. They were of a rare, rare species of people who are naturally comical and who could remember every joke they'd ever heard and knew how to tell them. I forget every joke I hear. It just goes right in and right out. Well, they had this natural banter, and they continued it all the time. Several times in the mid-50s, when I was 7 or 8 years old, we would go to the local baseball games together at the end of work, at the end of the day. Believe it or not, our team back then in Atlanta, our professional baseball team, was the Atlanta Crackers. We played in Ponce de Leon Ballpark in downtown Atlanta. And Peter and my dad and I would drive down there, and they would be cracking jokes. They had a bet on the daily Crackers game. Naturally, my dad bet for the Crackers, and Peter bet against the Crackers. I think it was 25 cents. Maybe it was a dollar. But we, on the way to the game, they would be bantering, and then as we got close to the ballpark, the banter would die out invariably, and they would get glum. And they would have to discuss how to meet after the game, because Peter had to go sit in the colored section. Ponce de Leon Ballpark, like everything else in Atlanta, was segregated. It was one of the few times that I ever remember actually running into segregation, where it was a factor. But I remember this, because walking to the park afterwards, my dad said, "I don't like this." More than once he said that. He said it in an unmistakable way, even to me as a child in that time. I knew it was a significant statement. I didn't think it was political. It wasn't that he was saying, I want to do something about segregation. He was not that kind of person. He felt that segregation was like a rainstorm. It's like, it's you endure it. It's the heavens. But what I think was he felt that he didn't like having to give up his banter and have it intrude upon his life. But what I really remember more than that, more than even speculating on what he was driving at, was that even as a small boy of 7 or 8 years old, I knew it was a significant statement and that I was not to ask any follow-up question. Like, what does this mean, or why is that, Dad, or what should we do? This was a dangerous topic. He communicated it nonverbally, and that this was the final word on that subject. That's what race was like for Southerners then. I think it's still, to some degree, like that for all of us here today. It is intimate, but it is alien. Peter died not too long after that, in the late 1950s. My dad and I went to the funeral. We were the only white people there. It was the first time I'd been in a black church. And then the preacher got up and said, "I see that Mr. Branch is here. Would he like to come up and say a few words?" My dad goes up into the pulpit and starts telling Peter Mitchell stories and completely broke down in the pulpit. It was one of the first times I ever saw my own father cry in a black service there for Peter Mitchell. And it was one of the first things that got me thinking about the place of race in the South, that here was clearly a strong bond between them, and yet we, of course, were never in Peter's home. We couldn't say we were friends, didn't go to the same churches. It was this intimate sense of separation that we had. The civil rights movement pounded against that as a boy in my formative years, and against my notion that it was frightful to everyone, black people and white people alike. You avoided it. It was an undertow. It was frightful. And I remember the first speculations against that came from Peter, and the second ones really came from the world of music. I was struck in the late 1950s and early 60s, when I was a formative teenager, by the fact that even though I was in the Atlanta Boy Choir and claimed to disdain rock and roll music, which was relatively new then, somebody brought me up short driving to high school saying, "If you don't like this music, how come it, when these songs come on the radio, you know all the words to Jackie Wilson songs and to the Drifters and the Tams and the Temptations, and you know every single word like that?" And I had to admit that it was true, and I started wondering about music and why it was that my people, white Southerners in segregated South, would never dream of courting their girlfriends to the music of anybody but black singers. If they were square, maybe Johnny Mathis. But otherwise, we believe that while we were naturally formed by God to wear neckties and use big words and run the world, that black people had the keys to the emotions beneath us that really ran us. And what a great mystery that was, that some of the most racist kids that I knew were the very ones who would sneak out and go down to the Royal Peacock in Atlanta to hear Jackie Wilson or Sam Cooke, the people that we felt really understood the emotional interior of our lives. I resisted civil rights and politics like a good son until 1963 in the fall when I was 16. I'd been asking these questions, like about Peter and music, during the years of relentless sit-ins and freedom rides, raising very fundamental questions that we were all frightened of. But when I was 16, in the spring of my junior year, I saw the dogs and fire hoses loosed on young children half my age in Birmingham. And it had it stupefied me. And I asked my parents, "How can this be? Where did it come from, that these young girls were marching into dogs and fire hoses, mostly girls?" I made a point of putting a photograph of it years later in the book, how young they were, that they were children. And they were singing songs very much like I sang in Sunday school, and they weren't running from the dogs and fire hoses, and they were melting America's resistance to do something about the civil rights movement, to do something about the segregation laws, and their influence went all around the world. But they're not studied in political science today. They're not studied in history, because we are not comfortable with the breadth of our influence and who our founding fathers at times have been. That's the issue that I want to raise with you today, is the gap between what I call the miracles and the myths growing out of the civil rights era. In a way, I want today, for provocations purposes, if nothing else, to violate all the rules that I have in my trilogy, which is to use storytelling. I believe we make discoveries across cultural barriers, not by abstract analysis, but by things that are so human that we forget our abstract categories for a moment. I believe we learn by stories. Of course, the Bible believes the same thing. It introduces us to everything in the cosmos, but by page two or three, we've got brothers killing brothers and squabbles within families, and they teach by stories that are human. I want to violate these rules by offering some generalizations to you about myths and miracles from this period, because I think it brings it up to the contemporary challenge in our life with the lessons coming out of this era. One myth is that there were no miracles from the 1960s, that what we learned was that these problems are intractable, that problems are as bad as ever, and that it was a waste of time. And that it was a threat instead, as we were warned by the people resisting the civil rights movement at the time. Strom Thurmond said that there were not enough troops in America to force Southerners to allow black people to go into hotels, to go into restaurants, to go into public libraries where they were restricted by the segregation laws. Black people couldn't check books out. All this, that it would require violence at such a level that we would never have it. Other people, Governor Ross Barnett, said that the whole civil rights era was a conspiracy of the news media and totalitarian forces to centralize control of all of American life in Washington, that this was a conspiracy. Richard Russell said the South is already, one of our great statesmen who would have been president had it not been for the segregation issue, I believe. Richard Russell said the South was already the poorest region of the country. It was, as he put it, the hookworm belt. And that if the civil rights laws forced the South, coerced the South into enacting equal opportunity, which is what the civil rights movement called it, it would be the enslavement of white people. It would further impoverish the South. And as he put it, garden variety white people would have no chance in life in a straitjacketed, enslaved, totally government-dominated society. The South defended the established order from this centralized threat that it perceived with terrorism and violence on a large, rather mass scale. We didn't notice a lot of it. Some of it was official, some of it was unofficial. Jeremiah Reeves was executed during the Montgomery bus boycott for stealing less than $2 in Alabama. Nobody noticed. These sorts of things didn't really register. Homes and churches were burned. Terrorism rose. But it didn't work. And I think that the first miracle that we need to acknowledge is that not only did terrorism subside, and justice at long last, 30, 40 years later, in the cases of some of the Emmett Till murder, the 1964 triple murder in Neshoba County, where on the first night of Freedom Summer, two white kids and a local black kid were lynched on the very first night of Freedom Summer. That crime was only solved and someone convicted in the state of Mississippi 2 years ago, preacher killing. These things took a long time. But not only did terror survive, but what on an empirical basis became of the prediction that we would become an impoverished totalitarian society in which white people were enslaved? Martin Luther King predicted, on the contrary, that the civil rights movement would liberate the white South. And certainly it did. You never heard of the Sun Belt when it was segregated. It's been the most rapidly growing part of the country ever since. My mayor, Ivan Allen in Atlanta, said as soon as the Civil Rights Bill passed, we built a sports stadium on land we didn't own with money we didn't have for a team we hadn't found. And they lured the Milwaukee Braves down to become the Atlanta Braves, the first professional sports team in the South. Danny Thomas created the Miami Dolphins right after that because segregation no longer hindered commerce in the South. The South was liberated, not just economically, but psychologically, but politically. As I said, Richard Russell couldn't be president because Southerners were stigmatized by race. Now, for better or worse, I leave that to you, Southerners are most of the leaders of both national parties, and they serve as in the Congress in positions of leadership that were off limits in the era of segregation. But I bet you Bill Frist very seldom gives thanks that he can be Senate Majority Leader because he stands on the shoulders of Fannie Lou Hamer. And people in the civil rights movement who made it possible for there to be two-party competition in the South by risking their lives to create 3 million new black voters in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which stimulated two-party competition in a region that had been stultified for a century by one-party white supremacy rule. South liberated economically, every other way. But it wasn't just that. As Dr. King said, these principles are not about race. They are about larger opportunity. They are about the equality of souls before God and the equality of votes in the American tradition of freedom. But it liberated women as well. The 1964 Civil Rights Act outlawed discrimination in employment by sex as well as race. The first time that was pointed out to the people whose job was to enforce those laws, they laughed. They thought it was ridiculous to enforce freedom, equal opportunity for women. You may forget that New York Times continued their separate help wanted ads, help wanted male, help wanted female, for years after they abolished help wanted white and help wanted colored. The most common job category for women until 1966 was Girl Friday, along which was a mixture of office assistant and secretary and that sort of thing. In 1966, 2 years after the Voting Rights, after the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission ruled that the airline industry had what they call a BFOQ, bona fide occupational qualification, for firing any airline stewardess who either reached the age of 33 or married. You could only be a stewardess if you were single and if you were younger than 33. Martha Griffiths, the wonderful author of that in the Congress, the congresswoman from Michigan, very bluntly called them before a hearing and said to the presidents of the major airlines, if you want to run a whorehouse in the sky, get a license. And she eventually did break that down, along with the help wanted female ads. But that's only emblematic for the things that we take for granted because we want to take them for granted, we don't want to see them for struggle, and because we're not accustomed to attributing them in the broad sense to the civil rights movement. Women couldn't go to most private colleges in the United States at that time. Those barriers were broken down. They couldn't go to many public universities like my University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where we had some junior transfers and nursing students, but only 5% of the student body at the state university by state law was female. All that changed when people started struggling over what equal citizenship means. And they changed, I submit, for the better. I'd like to tell you just briefly a story of Paulie Murray, one of my great heroes from that, heroines from that period. She was a black lawyer. She had been turned down by Chapel Hill, my university, her application, in an official letter that said, we do not accept students of your race. She was then turned down later by Harvard Law School in an official letter, I kid you not, that said, "We do not accept students of your sex." She persisted anyway, became a civil rights lawyer, an associate of Dr. King's, famous for her law review article on the origins of Jane Crow as opposed to Jim Crow and the similarities between them. But in my last book, I was stunned to find out that she was one of the lawyers who filed the lawsuit that overturned state laws that prohibited jury service by women of all races, any kind of jury. This is 1966. You can look it up. White v. Crook. Alabama law forbade women to serve on any jury, grand jury, petty jury, criminal jury, civil jury, any jury. They could be lawyers. They could be the chief judge of the Alabama court, but they couldn't serve on a jury because the language was too indelicate for them in a criminal trial. They couldn't do that. And I kid you not, the reigning Supreme Court decision then was Hoyt v. Florida, which upheld a Florida law saying that if you live in Florida and you're a female and you want to serve on a jury, you have to affirmatively go down and sign an affidavit asking to be considered in the jury pool and verifying that it would not interfere with your homemaking duties. Now, that's the United States, 1966. Paulie Murray filed suit against that, got it overturned. There were several states like Alabama that had these blanket laws, and then many, many other states like Florida that severely restricted the rights of women to serve on juries. We forgot that that lawsuit, by the way, came out of a Klan murder case in which an all-white male jury had acquitted a Klansman of murdering a civil rights worker, Jonathan Daniels, in broad daylight in Lowndes County, Alabama, where the Black Panthers came from. So the civil rights movement liberated not just blacks from terrorism and white people from poverty, white Southerners from poverty, and women from all the compartments that kept them from dreaming of being astronauts or going to Harvard or serving on juries in many places. But it also liberated an ecumenical spirit in religion. There had never been a female rabbi in 2,000 years of rabbinic Judaism until the civil rights movement put that little grit in the oyster of religion, too. What's equal citizenship mean? What does equal souls mean? And the first female rabbi was ordained in 1972 under the influence of the civil rights movement. Paulie Murray, the one who filed the White v. Crook, decided in her 60s, she was a lifelong Episcopalian, that it was not right that that women couldn't be priests in the Episcopal Church. She went to seminary. Almost the age of 70, she was in the first group, 1976, of ordained Episcopal priests. Paulie Murray was. She says, "Today, the principles in that and in White v. Crook on juries are so obvious that we can barely remember the world before that. But we forget it at our peril because we forget the struggle of fundamental questions that it came out of." Finally, on religion, I'd just like to remind you that the Vatican Council of 1965, in the full spirit of the civil rights movement and with the complicit agitation of King's dear friend, Rabbi Abraham Heschel, promulgated the doctrine that rescinded the contempt for Jews in the Vatican Council statement on religion in October of 1965. It contained three words that are revolutionary not only in the history of religion but in the history of politics. It envisioned a day when Christianity and Judaism would stand not one in triumph and the other in subjugation, not with the Jews all miraculously converted or not, but would stand shoulder to shoulder in worship of a common God. Now, these three words, shoulder to shoulder, are horizontal as opposed to vertical. They are in the spirit of the American Revolution, which transformed all previous political theory from the vertical, kings and lords, to the horizontal, what common citizens can do together. Shoulder to shoulder, fully in the spirit, largely forgotten. And finally, I'd like to mention the miracles that we neglect, the spread of the spirit of civil rights abroad. We all, most of us in this room, live to dread an Armageddon that would end the Cold War. We built mountains of nuclear weapons on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And yet, in the end of the 1980s, the Soviet Empire dissolved without an Armageddon, without war, without violence. Years after years of sit-ins on the shipyards in Gdansk in Poland, inspired by the spirit of religion and in resistance. And they sang, "We shall overcome," on the streets of Prague and when the Berlin Wall came down. And then Nelson Mandela came out of prison in South Africa, where we had even been even more certain, if possible, that some sort of racial bloodbath would be required to challenge apartheid, if anything could there. And instead of words of vengeance, he came out with words of reconciliation and envisaging a biracial democracy that had never existed in South Africa. And it came to pass, largely without violence, still struggling to be born, still a miracle in the modern world, still in the spirit of the civil rights movement. And Americans, above all people, remain numb to our own inspiration as it spreads around the world. Even Tiananmen Square was modeled on a sit-in. There have been rebellions in China for 5,000 years, but never one modeled on a sit-in of nonviolent students facing tanks in Tiananmen Square. They didn't win, but the seed of democracy was planted there through nonviolence modeled on the sit-in.